Reading Melville's diary is very interesting for a variety of reasons, including the fact that some of his reflections parallel those of Mark Twain's visit in 1867. But unlike Twain, Melville actually in his diary pondered the question of Jewish return to the land. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 151, The American Consul to Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In 1822, Thomas Jefferson, celebrating freedom of inquiry and faith in America, made what is today a well-known prediction. Quote, "I trust that there is not a young man now living in the United States who will not die a Unitarian," end quote. Of course, Jefferson's own prognostication was obviously incorrect. The 19th century in the United States was one of religious fervor featuring profound diversity in doctrines. And perhaps one of the best examples of this is the story of the man to first be appointed as American consul to Jerusalem. This man was a Philadelphian by the name of Warder Cresson, who started out as a Quaker before embracing, among others, the Shakers and the Latter-day Saints, before turning to Judaism. And he, too, would have a prediction that paralleled the dream of Moses Montefiore, a dream of Jewish return to the Holy Land, a dream that, as we will see, was denounced as a fantasy by a man who would ultimately become one of the most famous of American authors. But it was this dream and this prediction of Jewish return that would come true. Warder Cresson, a descendant of Quakers, spent much of the first part of his life in the first part of the 19th century, in which he married and had six children, examining and embracing different forms of religious observance. In this, he was like many other Americans in that age. But then Warder Cresson did something unexpected. He turned to Judaism. And while this did not immediately lead to his embrace of the Jewish faith, it did introduce him to the proto-Zionist ideas of a Jewish American that we have mentioned before in this podcast. Cresson got to know the spiritual leader of Congregation Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia, Isaac Leeser. And through his engagement with this congregation, he became familiar with the writings of Mordecai Noah. I cite Michael Medved's essay on Cresson in commentary to which this episode is indebted. Quote, "As the synagogue's leader, Leeser patiently engaged Cresson in wide-ranging discussions on biblical interpretation and messianic redemption while introducing him to the work of Mordecai Emanuel Noah, a Jewish political operative and man of letters who had begun pushing for an American commitment to reestablish a Jewish homeland in the Middle East," end quote. We must pause for a moment to note the unique history of the Jewish congregation in which Cresson found himself. Mikveh Israel was founded by the Patriot Jews of New York who fled Manhattan in advance of the British taking the city during the American Revolution. This was the congregation that had been led spiritually by Gershom Mendes Seisius, a clergyman whose support for the revolution was well known, and its community at the outset contained famous patriots like Chaim Solomon, as well as Jonas Phillips, who was a friend of the famous patriot and Philadelphian Benjamin Rush. One of the first donors to the creation of the synagogue was Benjamin Franklin. This was, in other words, the perfect congregation to inspire Cresson to consider the connection between the Jewish people and America, and Cresson did exactly that. Medved tells us that in encountering the proto-Zionism of Mordecai Emanuel Noah, quote, Cresson became instantly captivated by that idea, end quote. And that Cresson, quote, also reached the conclusion that God himself had created the United States for one purpose above all others, rescuing the Jews of the world from exile and oppression. He discerned profound significance in the young republic's national symbol, since the prophet Isaiah had promised for the weary and faint-hearted that the Lord will renew their strength, they will soar on wings like eagles. He felt sure that the prophecy of a reborn Israel would be fulfilled by the soaring power of the American eagle that would overshadow the land with his wings. Medved continues, to assure his own role in these miraculous forthcoming events, he contacted a friendly Philadelphia congressman named E. Joy Morris to arrange his appointment as America's first consul to Jerusalem. At the time, the holy city that loomed so large in religious imagery had degenerated into a rundown, isolated village of barely 15,000 souls, half of them Jewish, that hardly merited its own consulate by any conventional calculation. But Representative Morris wrote to Secretary of State John C. Calhoun that the American pilgrims and missionaries who visited Jerusalem in increasing numbers could benefit from a diplomatic outpost in that remote corner of the Ottoman Empire. More important, he made it clear that Warder Cresson, relying on his personal wealth, had volunteered to work for the government without compensation. This was an offer that the perennially cash-strapped State Department could hardly refuse, so the official appointment came through on May 17, 1844, end quote. Thus did the first American consulate in Jerusalem come into being. Sort of. The appointment was immediately questioned, and the Tyler administration withdrew it almost as soon as it had been made. But Crescent was already on his way to the Holy Land, where he conducted himself as an American consul. 4 years later, his religious seeking took its next step, or as Crescent put it, quote, I remained in Jerusalem in my former faith until the 20th day of March, 1848, when I became fully satisfied that I never could obtain strength and rest but by doing as Ruth did, end quote. And he adds, I was circumcised, entered the Holy Covenant, and became a Jew. Having informed his family, Crescent came back to America to find that his wife had had Crescent declared insane, which would allow her to take control of every aspect of the family's finances. This was, of course, outrageous, for it effectively argued that Crescent's embrace of Judaism proved that he was insane. Crescent fought this in court, and what followed is one of the most interesting of law and religious cases in early America. Medved tells us, quote, Crescent's lawyer, the eminent Horatio Hubbell Jr., characterized the case as a crucial test of the religious liberty guaranteed by the First Amendment. His impassioned closing statement ended with a dramatic denunciation of the attempt to discredit an unconventional thinker based on his religious ideas alone. The only charge left with which to accuse my client, he thundered, is that he became a Jew. By that time, the newspapers covering the trial had swung to support Crescent's cause, and they unanimously expressed their jubilation at his vindication. Philadelphia's Public Ledger saw the decision as settling forever the principle that a man's religious opinions never can be made the test of his sanity. Having overturned the prior verdict of lunacy, the court enabled the newly minted Michael Boaz Israel ben Avraham to continue worshiping at Philadelphia's Mikveh Israel congregation, where he enjoyed the status of local hero and meticulously followed Jewish religious law. He used, Medved continues, his last months in the United States to pen a spiritual autobiography filled with exultant, sometimes terrifying prophecies, predicting the imminent rebirth of the land of Israel and the ingathering of the exiles, despite unimaginable trials and terrors, end quote. So Medved writes, divorced from his wife, Crescent ultimately returned to the land of Israel and married again to a Jewish woman. Then, perhaps most interesting of all, as Medved references, is the fact that in the Holy Land, Crescent encountered someone who would later become famous, Herman Melville. We have Melville's diary from that period, describing his visit, and excerpts of the diary were published in commentary by Shalom J. Kahn in 1957. In one passage, Melville wrote, Warder Crescent of Philadelphia, an American-turned-Jew, divorced from former wife, married a Jewess, etc. And then Melville adds the word, sad. Reading Melville's diary is very interesting, for a variety of reasons, including the fact that some of his reflections parallel those of Mark Twain's visit in 1867, which we shall soon discuss. But unlike Twain, Melville actually in his diary pondered the question of Jewish return to the land and referenced another individual that has appeared in our story, a man whom we will soon discuss again. Melville wrote, quote, Sir Moses Montefiore, this Croesus visited Palestine last year, bought a large tract on the hill of Gihon and walled it in for hospital grounds. A huge man of 75, he was carried to Jerusalem from Joppa on a litter borne by mules. They fleeced him sadly, charging enormous prices for everything he bought. Sir M. seems to have the welfare of his poor countrymen near his heart, and, it is said, purposes returning here for life, end quote. Melville then goes on in his diary to disparage the possibility of a Jewish return, writing, quote, The idea of making farmers of the Jews is vain. In the first place, Judea is a desert with few exceptions. In the second place, the Jews hate farming, end quote. And Melville concludes with words of scorn that I find amazing to this day. Melville wrote, quote, Besides, the number of Jews in Palestine is comparatively small. And how are the hosts of them scattered in other lands to be brought here? Only by a miracle, end quote. Only by a miracle, those are Melville's words. Truth is that Melville was right, but not in the way that he intended. It would take a miracle. It did take a miracle. And Medved, in his article's conclusion, considers the remarkable nature of the fulfillment of Crescent's dream, writing, quote, In 2013, however, renewed interest in the disputes and oddities of Warder Crescent's turbulent life led to the rediscovery of his damaged but still identifiable gravestone. It turned up among the relics in the crowded and ancient cemetery on the Mount of Olives, where it was suitably restored as a small memorial not long before his two homelands took the joint historic step of establishing the first American embassy in Crescent's holy capital of Jerusalem. His contemporaries had dismissed him as a strange bird, but Warder Crescent anticipated the Zionist visions that later changed the world, while advancing the idea that America's destiny providentially connected her to a restored Israel. After his death, The miraculous events that unfolded in and around his Jerusalem home also established him as the posthumous but indisputable winner of his prophetic arguments with Herman Melville." End quote. Melville's diary reminded me of the passage from the children's book The Phantom Tollbooth, in which the boy Milo, along with his traveling companion the Humbug, returns from his quest to be told by the kings Azaz and the Mathemagician the following. Quote, "That's why," said Azaz, "there was one very important thing about your quest that we couldn't discuss until you returned." "I remember," said Milo eagerly. "Tell me now." "It was impossible," said the king, looking at the Mathemagician. "Completely impossible," said the Mathemagician, looking at the king. "Do you mean," said the bug, who suddenly felt a bit faint. "Yes, indeed," they repeated together. "But if we told you then, you might not have gone. And as you've discovered, so many things are possible. Just as long as you don't know, they're impossible." End quote. Crescent's story is a fascinating one, and it reflects the fact that the 19th century tale of Jerusalem is itself fascinating. And in the story that we are telling, the Jewish quest for the seemingly impossible will unfold. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.